Today's speaker is Nikos Tsingelis. Nikos is a senior program analyst with EPA's NPDES Stormwater Program. He's been with the agency for over 18 years in many different positions. His career has focused on the Clean Water Act. He's been with the Stormwater Program for the last 6 years and works on many projects aimed at helping the Phase 2 communities implement this challenging program. Good afternoon, Nikos.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Welcome, everybody. I'm glad that you all are with us today to talk about stormwater, which is a very important part of any watershed planning and protection activity. And I wanted to do a couple things today, since most of the people on the line today are with a watershed organization or are somehow involved in watershed planning. I wanted to take a few minutes to give you an overview of what the NPDES program is all about, and particularly how the stormwater piece of that works, and then talk about why stormwater is a problem, kind of giving you a national scale as to the kinds of problems that we are encountering and trying to address, and then to talk about the different parts of the stormwater program. There are six what we call minimum measures that communities need to follow as they build their stormwater programs, and I wanted to talk to you about each one of those and give you a very quick overview, and also talk about some ideas about how watershed groups can become more involved in the whole stormwater management process at the local level. And then finally, I wanted to focus on permanent stormwater controls. We call them sort of post-construction, what happens on a site after it's built. And I wanted to tell you about that part of the program and also about some new ideas involving smart growth and low-impact development ideas, which are places where we're really trying to move communities to sort of think in new and creative ways to get better performance out of these long-term stormwater management plans that they're implementing. So those are the main topics of today's discussion. So let's flip to slide three, and if you don't get anything else out of this webcast, at least maybe you'll come to figure out the answer to this question. If you look at our website, you'll find that we're pretty confused about this as well, but we've decided that stormwater is one word. So most people seem to be in agreement with that, so if you come out with nothing else, at least you'll know that. Let's go to slide four, and we're going to talk now, just kind of as a piece of background so that everybody has the same common language to talk from, about what the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System is, that's NPDES, how those permits work, and some of the sort of basics that you need to understand to sort of navigate that whole system. So let's flip to slide five, please. And the NPDES framework has been part of the Clean Water Act since it was enacted in 1972. And basically there are sort of three main points that we need to consider for who must get an NPDES permit. The first is that it must be a point source. And I'll talk a little bit about this in a minute as to exactly what a point source is. But basically we're looking at a particular place that pollution is being discharged into a water of the United States. Second, there's got to be pollutants. So if it's clean water, there's no need for an NPDES permit. But in most cases, the kinds of things that we'll be talking about, there are pollutants there, and so those would require. And then finally, is it discharging into a water of the U.S.? And the water of the U.S. is a relatively wide definition. It includes rivers, lakes, coastal waters, bays, estuaries. It also includes wetlands. It includes playa lakes and other sort of special features that are found in certain parts of the country. On our website, which I'll mention, is mentioned in the resources later, you can find a complete definition of what the waters of the U.S. are. So if a particular discharge is meeting all three of these characteristics, that it is a point source, that there are pollutants, and it's going into a water of the U.S., they must obtain an NPDES permit from an authorized state or EPA. Let's move to slide six. So some of this we've covered, but basically under the Clean Water Act, it's illegal for anyone to discharge pollutants without a permit. And a permit is not a license. It is or it is a license rather, but it is not a right, and it can be taken away when people mistreat that license, or when they violate the terms of the permit, when they violate water quality standards. So let's move on again to slide 7. And please let me know if I'm moving too quickly. You can send us a comment through the question mark box there. There are many different kinds of point sources, and we'll talk about some of the obvious ones that you probably think of when you think of who's polluting surface waters are industries, of course. Those are, industrial pollution in 1972 was one of the main reasons why the Clean Water Act was enacted in the first place. In addition to that, another very common one is municipal sewage treatment plants. Those were also a major cause of water pollution in the 1960s and 1970s. And since that time, the definition of what a point source has expanded considerably, and that's part of what we're going to talk about here in the stormwater program. And by the way, just in case you're curious, the ducks and the fish down below are not point sources. Let's move to we can skip ahead to slide 9. On slide 8, there is a picture of what you would consider sort of the traditional 1972 point source, a big pipe discharging pollutants. On slide 9, there's a definition of what a point source is. One thing I will point out is that it is a discrete conveyance. It does not need to be a pipe. It can be any kind of man-made device that can be used to convey wastewater or pollutants into a water of the U.S. And it gives you some examples there, including ditches and channels, tunnels, conduits, et cetera, et cetera. And it also includes animal feeding operations and some discharges even from boats. And as you probably all know, agriculture is largely exempt from the protections of the Clean Water Act. In particular, irrigation return flows, which you might think of as a discrete point source, are exempt at present. Let's move to slide 10. Slide 10 talks about what is the definition of a pollutant. And again, I won't go through all this. It's there for your reference. But it's all the things that you would think of. It is industrial, on the bottom there, it's industrial, municipal, and agricultural waste discharged into water. It includes sediment. It includes all kinds of toxic pollutants. It includes solid waste. It even includes, interestingly, changes in temperature. Heat is actually defined as a pollutant under the Clean Water Act, and that will be important to part of our discussion for stormwater a little bit later. Let's move to slide 11. Slide 11 just gives you a little perspective on the number of entities that we are regulating under the NPDES program. In 1972, we started off with a baseline of approximately 60,000 entities out there that had to get NPDES permits. Those were the large industrial facilities and sewage treatment plants across the country. And we remained relatively static with that universe of permittees until about 1992, when the stormwater rules went into effect. And you can see in 1992, phase one of the stormwater rules went into effect and jumped that universe up by 300,000 additional entities, including construction sites, industrial sites that had stormwater discharges, and also municipalities, and we'll get into that as well. And then just to summarize, just recently in 2003, actually, the regulations became final for Stormwater Phase 2, and that added another 200,000 entities. So we've gone from a place where we were dealing with 60,000 folks to now where we're dealing with over 600,000. And if you really think about that, because we are including cities in here, we're including millions and millions and millions of people as well. And I'll explain a little bit of that as well as we go on. On slide 12, you'll see, I mentioned before that anybody that needs a permit must obtain one from an authorized state or EPA. And at this point, almost every state is authorized to implement the NPDES program. The ones in green on your slide have full authority for implementing the NPDES program, and so they run the program on their own. They issue permits, they do the enforcement, they do the inspections, and basically it's sort of a soup-to-nuts kind of thing. EPA is still the permitting authority in five states, which is Alaska, Idaho, New Mexico, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire, as well as some of the territories like Puerto Rico, also, we are the permitting authority in Indian country lands. So Indian country lands that are within a particular state are actually covered by EPA in almost every single case. Okay, let's move on to slide 13. Just to give you an idea, every NPDES permit is valid for 5 years. It cannot be written for more than 5 years. So at every 5 years, every permit comes up for review again. And this is particularly important if you're concerned about particular issues with a discharger, in that you will have the opportunity again to participate in that reissuance of the permit. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on, too. So these things are not set in stone forever. The other thing that tends to happen, too, is that there'll be changes in some of the scientific background that goes into these permits. And so permit limits will be changed and generally made more stringent as new science becomes available. There are appeal process. There is a public comment, review and comment period for all permits, and there are also appeal processes as well. Let's move on to slide 14. The public notice period for permits is generally 30 days, and every major permit, and I can explain all that as well, requires a 30-day comment period. Also, if there is controversy or interest in having one, the public may also ask for a hearing, and that hearing extends automatically the comment period for a total of 60 days. And then, as it says there, EPA does review major permits, and also general permits that cover a wide geographic area, and any ones where there are particular controversial aspects. But again, every permit that's issued has a 30-day comment period, and so we encourage watershed groups to be involved in that, and then to request hearings to vet particular issues if you feel that those are not being addressed sufficiently. It's a key part of that process. Just to let you know, just kind of a summary of some of the enforcement provisions. First of all, violators are subject to fines up to $32,500 a day. So that's pretty hefty. It can certainly make people, pay attention to the details because it can add up very quickly. And there are other penalties there, and there are other ways of dealing with those issues. By the way, we're on slide 15 in case you missed that. And then the last thing I'd mention here on citizen suits, the Clean Water Act does provide citizens and watershed groups the opportunity to sue as well. And that, of course, would be kind of a last-ditch effort if you couldn't get your concerns addressed through public comment periods and the like. But you should know that that is available to you as well. Okay, let's go on to slide 16. Just a little bit more about NPDES permits. First of all, there are two kinds of permits, and this was a development that happened when we got into the stormwater program because of all the extra entities out there that required regulation. Originally, we had started writing one permit to one facility, which was the way we did it from 1972 to about 1992 for the most part. And but with the advent of the stormwater program, we had to find a more expeditious way of handling all those entities. So we now have something called general permits, where all the entities that have similar characteristics can be covered under one sort of umbrella permit. So, for instance, construction sites are often covered by a general permit across an entire state. So every construction site that's going on in a particular place applies for coverage under this umbrella permit, rather than having to actually request the issuance of a complicated individual NPDES permit. I already mentioned that they're issued by states, and the term is 5 years, and of course you have the opportunity for a public review and comment. So now let's move into a little bit of a fun piece of this, and we'll see how this goes with this webcast format. But what I thought I'd do here, we're on slide 17, is there are a series of pictures in the next several slides. And since we've talked about the difference as to what a point source is, the alternative, of course, is a non-point source. And so I'll give you a few seconds for each slide to just decide if you're with a group, you can talk about it amongst yourselves. If you're by yourself, you can just, make a note as to whether you think the particular picture describes a point source or a non-point source. And then I'll give you, say, maybe 10 seconds to think about that. And then I'll give you the answer. And so you can see how well you did with this little game. Okay, so let's move to slide 18. And you can see here the picture of a sewage treatment plant. So that should give it away pretty quickly. All right. So obviously, this one is a point source. Okay. Let's move to slide 19. I'll give you a few seconds here. Okay. This is not exactly clear as to what this is, but it is a pipe. And remember, earlier we mentioned any kind of discrete conveyance, including a pipe. And so we'll assume that this is a point source. Because we assume there must be some pollutants in this water coming out of this thing. Now, we don't know exactly where this is coming from, whether it's coming from an industrial facility or whether it's a stormwater pipe or what it is, but it is a point source. Okay, let's move to slide 20. And again, I will give you a few seconds. Okay, so here we see a large urbanized area, an aerial view. And I think many of you might say, well, I don't see any pipe, I don't see any ditch, so this must be a non-point source. But actually, this is a point source. Under every street here, there's a storm sewer system. The curbs along the streets actually are part of that conveyance, so they're conveying storm water to those inlets. And the storm sewer system then is just discharging into some nearby river. So this entire area is actually a point source. Okay, let's move to slide 21. I hope everybody knows what this is, but in case you don't, it is a septic system being installed. And, of course, you can see that it has some pipes and that sort of thing. So you might, again, think that this is a point source, but this is kind of a trick. This is not a point source. This is a non-point source because it does not discharge directly to a water of the U.S. It is the wastewater coming out of that pipe is discharging into the ground, so it's being dispersed before it gets to a water of the U.S. So in most cases, the septic system would not be considered a point source and therefore not require an NPDES permit. That, of course, doesn't mean that you won't have problems with them and that they're not stormwater issues. We talk about septic systems as very important stormwater issues, but technically they're not a point source. However, if that pipe, say, were to be extended out to a nearby creek, then it definitely would be a point source. And there are some parts of the country, particularly with very old septic systems, where they were actually designed that way. And those would actually be illegal, and we would want them to be retrofit. But that's relatively rare nowadays. Let's move to slide 22. And on slide 22, another aerial view here, we see a construction site. And here again, you may start to wonder, well, is this a point source or a non-point source? Certainly sediment can run off this site, but is it a point source or a non-point source? And actually, administratively, we have defined construction sites as point sources. So the entire construction site is a point source. This is part of the sort of that gray area where, a background knowledge of exactly what's what is sort of required to interpret this. But construction sites, when they disturb over 1 acre, as of 2003 with the Phase 2 requirements, if the area disturbed, as it looks like it is here, more than 1 acre, then it is defined as a point source. Okay, let's move on to slide 23. And here we see farm fields, stream, and some cows enjoying the stream. And again, this is sort of a trick. This is bad, but it's not a point source. We definitely want to keep the cows out of the stream, but they are not point sources. Okay, let's move to slide 24. Another aerial view here. A couple seconds. Okay, and this is a farm field. And as I mentioned, agriculture is generally exempt from the Clean Water Act, and farm fields, row cropping, are exempt, so this is a non-point source. Okay, let's move to slide 25, and now we're back to the cows again, and this time lots of cows, there is yet another special provision under the NPDES program where large animal feeding operations, the big feedlots, generally, in this case, since we're talking about cows, when they have generally over 1,000 cows in a confined area, such as the one that we're looking at, they are a point source. So those are defined as a point source. And there are, they can have cows, they can have chickens, they can have sheep. There are different numbers for the thresholds as to when they turn into a point source. But those are regulated and do require a permit. Okay, and slide 26, I think you can figure that out for yourself. Okay, let's open it up for some questions. So if you want to submit a question, you can do so through the computer. And I think we'll take those first. We'll have some phone questions.
Nikos, we do have a question here from Randy, who wants to know, why is agricultural runoff that is routed through drain tiles and or ditches not defined as a point source and regulated under the NPDES program?
Okay, well, actually, it is a point source. However, Congress
decided to specifically exempt it from the Clean Water Act. So I can't speak for as to why Congress decided this, but that has been in the Clean Water Act since 1972, and I guess the short answer is talk to your congressman. Next, is there another question?
Yeah, we have a question from Michael in Pennsylvania who asks, not all municipalities are required to be permitted. So how are borderline municipalities determined as requiring an MS4 permit?
You are right about that, and we'll get into that very shortly as to exactly what those definitions are. So if you can just hold on, we've got a few slides that cover that.
And I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines. Our folks, do folks have questions on the line for
Nico? I have one question.
Sure.
Okay. I was wondering if volume would play a role in deciding whether it's a point source or a non-point source, but I didn't see that anywhere.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Can you repeat that question?
I was wondering if volume, increased volume, significantly increased volume, would be determine it to be a point source.
Increased volume.
Yeah, nothing being added to the water, just a very sharp increased volume for a small period of time.
The question was about volume, and the answer strictly...
No, increased volume by itself is not a pollutant. However, in most cases, it is often going to be coming from a point source, such as storm sewer system. So in that case, yeah. So it matters as to where this volume is coming from.
Are there other folks on the phone lines that have questions for Nikos?
Yeah, this is Samuel James from Macon, Georgia. I'm asking a question regarding slide number 25. What did you say the trash threshold number of cows that makes it point us again?
Sorry, not over 1,000.
Threshold for cows is 1,000.
We don't know. I think
that's... And they're asking me what the thresholds for the
other animals are, but there are other thresholds for chickens and sheep and whatnot.
Any additional questions?
I have one. Hello?
We have an additional question on the telephone?
Yes, I have a question.
Go ahead.
This is Tim Foster in Dallas. I have a question regarding portable wastewater treatment facilities that could be utilized on the dairy lagoons to manage surface water runoff in this stormwater issue. Could it be, could that type of a system qualify as a best management practice in any future discussions?
Yeah, I believe so. I'm not entirely familiar with the technology that you're mentioning, but it certainly could be a best management practice. And it sounds like it might also be a point source.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and put the folks on mute and let Nikos continue on slide number 28.
Okay, so let's go to slide 29. The next part of this presentation is about stormwater problems, and just kind of to illustrate the kinds of problems that are out there, some of the information that we have from the National Water Quality Inventory on stormwater problems, and just to make you aware of sort of the things to look for. In that first bullet there is kind of the key to the whole thing. Stormwater basically is derived from changes in impervious surfaces, basically through disturbing land, changing land uses, and it results in two problems that we're really concerned about. One is stormwater quality, that is pollution that's being picked up as stormwater moves across the landscape, particularly a disturbed or impervious landscape. So it's picking up all kinds of pollutants, and also the changes in the hydrology, and what one of our questioners just mentioned was volume. And volume is a big consideration in the stormwater program. So we're trying to essentially minimize the pollution or the in actually preventing pollution from getting into stormwater. And we're also trying to minimize the volume or the changes in the hydrology that we're inflicting on systems through development. So we're concerned, obviously, sediment, according to the National Water Quality Inventory, is the largest pollutant, the most significant pollutant, particularly coming from any kind of runoff, whether that runoff is urban or agricultural. Also, right up there are nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, causing major problems throughout the United States. Also, looking, if you look, particularly I encourage you to look at what we call the list of impaired waters, or the 303D list under the Clean Water Act, and look and see whether, and it's probably likely that it is, that waters in your area, parts of your watershed, have been listed and what pollutants they have been listed for. And often you will find sediment and nutrients and bacteria being among the top ones. But in addition to that, we need to sort of take the Clean Water Act framework a little farther, and we need to talk about volume. Because we are changing the hydrology through development, and I'll talk more about that in some succeeding slides. And that is having some pretty significant impacts on particularly small-order rivers and streams. Okay, let's move on to slide 30. Slide 30 just gives you a few statistics from the National Water Quality Inventory, also called the 305B report, which is available on EPA's website. And I believe we have a reference for where that is as well. that urban runoff, and we're just here looking at urban runoff, not agricultural runoff, accounts for some 34,000 impaired stream miles, or 13% of all the rivers and streams that we know of that are impaired. And again, we're just looking at those that have been assessed, and of those that are impaired, about 13% are being caused by urban runoff problems. In lakes, it's a higher number. There's 1.4 million acres of lakes, or about 18% of all the impairments are caused by urban runoff. And finally, in estuaries, actually the highest impact, about 5,000 square miles, or 32% of all those impaired estuary square miles out there are being impacted by urban runoff. And that's probably no surprise to anyone either. I'm sure that you all have heard, that almost a great majority of the population, I think it's perhaps 50%, lives within 50 miles of a coastline. So we have much higher urbanized areas along the two coasts, and this would then cause that higher number there. Let's move to slide 31. Just some common pollutants. We've covered some of this already. Sediment, nutrients, various substances that will cause a depletion in the oxygen in the water. Also, bacteria, viruses, just your basic trash. Road salts, oil and grease, heavy metals, and heat again. I mentioned that, and we'll talk about that too. Let's move to slide 32. And on slide 32, we're starting to talk about the impact of development on the quality of stormwater runoff. And so as we increase impervious surface area, we are increasing stormwater volume, stormwater velocity, and the deposition of pollutants. And we're decreasing, obviously, stormwater quality, but interestingly enough, we're also decreasing groundwater recharge. And as you all know, groundwater is the source of drinking water for many, many people across the country. And because of the impervious surfaces and the changes in hydrology, that what used to soak into the ground is now being run off onto the surface. And so we are lowering the water tables in many parts of the country. This also affects base flow, means the base flow, that groundwater that recharges our rivers and streams. In dry periods, a river system relies on groundwater to keep flowing. And as these changes in hydrology occur, we're reducing that base flow to the stream. So we're having more extreme periods of high flows during the storms and then lower flows during the dry periods. In addition, changes in development is taking out the riparian corridors, the trees and life around sort of the sensitive headwaters in many streams. So that's changing and also causing some of those increases in temperature that we mentioned before. On slide 33, there's yet some more examples there, and I won't go through all of these, but flooding is also something to think about. Again, changes in hydrology can make those floods a lot flashier. Also, changes in the whole watershed structure are affecting biological populations as well. So let's move to slide 34. And now we have a series of pictures just to show in the next couple slides some of the impacts of stormwater runoff. And a lot of these are there for you to use in your own presentation, so you're free to steal them and use them as you like. But there are a number of things. On this first slide here, if you look at the top left, you can see where a river is going into a larger bay. And you can see the pollutants and sediments just dropping out as that water slows right down. In the middle left, we're also concerned about snow melt, particularly in a lot of urban areas during wintertime. You'll get a buildup of pollutants during the winter, and then when it melts, a very high concentration of pollutants will be delivered to a particular river system, for example. On the far right shows a couple pictures of fish kills and algal blooms, again from that nutrients, the interaction of nutrients causing these algal blooms, and then the algae dies and sucks all the oxygen out of the water. And then, of course, down below, sort of a traditional, you know, dumping of things on the streets and pollution getting in through storm drains, kind of the key to the whole thing. In slide 35, you see a big disaster picture. Obviously, this is sort of a rare occurrence, but it does show sort of the dramatic effects of water and erosion. On slide 36, you see another rather dramatic picture. And again, it's sort of interesting that this sewer stack here, this concrete fixture, kind of gives you an idea of where the ground used to be. And you'll find in river systems many places crossings of sewer lines that were originally under the stream bed that are now exposed, power lines, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of the sort of infrastructure can give you sort of a base as to see, you know, what's happening in your system. On slide 37, just a picture of some pretty muddy water coming out of a storm drain system there. On slide 38, at first glance you might say, well, that looks like a pretty healthy watershed. It's got good tree cover, the banks are intact, everything. But again, the land uses around this particular area have got to be pretty developed. And you can see the quality of the water there is very obviously brown and sediment filled. So in some places where it's not so obvious, you can get, you know, impacts from long ways upstream. And then quickly moving through some of these other pictures, obviously transportation, our network of slide 39, our network of transportation has got lots and lots of impacts. We already mentioned the impact of road salts, particularly in the wintertime, but also from airports, from their de-icing operations, and just the massive volumes that are coming off these paved areas as well. On slide 40, turf management. A lot of people think, well, you know, grass is pretty good. It's not so bad. But with the way that we manage our lawns in this country with the fertilizers and pesticides, we're actually contributing quite a lot from these areas to stormwater pollution. And in many cases also, you'll find that a lot of lawns or particularly high traffic areas around schools, like ball fields and whatnot, playgrounds, actually become impervious as they're used more and more. And so what might have infiltrated a relatively small storm at one point after a couple of years of heavy use will essentially become an impervious surface. And again, taking with it all the fertilizers and pesticides that we're putting on it. On slide 41, some more pictures, again, mostly for your use. Of course, in the bottom right there, oil and grease coming off of roadways is a major problem. And let's turn now to slide 42. And we'll stop here just for a second to explain some of the things that we've been talking about a little bit in more detail. If you look on this slide, you'll see the solid line represents the pre-development characteristics of a typical watershed. This is just, you know, for illustrative purposes. There's nothing, you know, scientific here, but this is just kind of an artistic vision of this. And in pre-development conditions, when we had a major rainstorm, the large storm on the left, and then a smaller following storm on the right, you had this peak runoff and then a recession. And then after the second small storm, just a very small increase again there. And then we're comparing that to post-development. So this is an area that has, let's say, become urbanized in the kinds of ways that we think of as urbanized. And again, you'll notice this much, much higher peak, and that peak comes a lot earlier in the process. And then a second peak there after that small storm is considerably higher again. So we have much more runoff volume overall. And then the other interesting thing to point out is that we've lowered that base flow. That's so essential, especially to small streams, to keep them flowing in dry periods because of this change in the hydrology of the system. So this kind of serves as kind of just a simple way to explain to people kind of what's going on, what are the impacts of development. So again, this is another slide that I encourage you to take and use for yourself. On slide 43, just kind of a different way of looking at the same things that we've been talking about, and this just gives you, again, some illustrative examples of what happens starting from the top left and then moving right and then downward as we get more and more impervious cover, as we develop more and more of what is happening to the sort of to the hydrology of the system and what changes are we seeing. So, for instance, in just a natural system that's mostly forested, you might expect 10% or even less than 10% of runoff, even during a heavy storm. And you're getting the other percentages there for shallow and deep infiltration, about 50% is going there, and evapotranspiration through the trees and vegetation is about 40%. As we change that to the 10 to 20% imperviousness, which isn't that much, by the way, I think 10% is about 2-acre lots. So that's not a lot when you sort of think about it. But you're doubling the amount of runoff that's coming off just through that change there and making the other changes to the system as well. And then if you continue on, I won't go through all these in detail, but you can see that there's pretty close relationship between the amount of impervious surface and the runoff that we expect. In fact, the folks at the Center for Watershed Protection estimate that this is actually about a 1-to-1 ratio. So if you have 10% impervious, you have about 10% runoff. If you have 50% impervious, you're going to get about 50% runoff. So their numbers are slightly different than this chart, but they're basically saying it's about a 1-to-1 ratio. Let's move to slide 44 for just a little bit of a case study. This is Blakesley Creek in Michigan. It's a small sub-watershed, a very small area. And this first slide here shows the land use patterns in 1997. And you can see most of this watershed was either forest or meadow, the green colors. And down in the bottom right, there's a little bit of residential area. And then compare that to slide 45, now, which is in 2001. And this middle piece of this watershed has now gotten completely developed, or just about completely developed. And then let's look on slide 46. There are two hydrographs to compare the runoff during the same storm events and looking at the runoff volumes here. So we've got a 70% increase in peak flow. That's that peak there that you see right at the beginning, that spike. That increased by 70%. We also have 170% increased runoff volume, which is the area, the blue area under the whole thing. And then if you look at another sort of interesting little thing, is you look at where the spike is in the first pre-development picture and how short that spike is, and then take that same level over into the post-development area, and you can see that that volume now lasts for 4 hours. So there's been some major, major changes in what's going on in this watershed because of this change in land use. Okay, on slide 47, also from our friends at the Center for Watershed Protection, is their sort of assessment of where we get into trouble with relating impervious cover to stream quality. And basically what they're saying here is that in a watershed with about 10% or less impervious cover, which again is relatively little, you have the chance for having pretty good stream quality. And this, by the way, applies to first and second order streams, so relatively small systems. We're not talking about the Mississippi River here. But as you move above 10%, you quickly get into impacts, and we'll show some pictures in a second. And then beyond about 25%, there's pretty much no hope of return to natural conditions at that point. And as kind of a little side note, they've been looking in hundreds of watersheds, and they found that if they get above 10% imperviousness in that particular watershed, one thing they notice is that those watersheds will not sustain a naturally recurring trout population, for instance. above 10%, there's no way that you're going to get trout to come back naturally. Under 10, that often happens. So certain species like trout and salmon are very sensitive to these changes in the way we're developing watersheds. Next, let's move to slide 48. And this is a series of slides that kind of illustrates what the center was talking about in that previous graph. Here's a picture of a watershed at about 5% impervious cover. And if you look at the picture, it's not the most clear picture in the world, but I think you can get a sense of what it looks like. You see good riparian cover, lots of trees. You see pretty stable stream banks. You see a nice, what they call pool and riffle structure, so that the water is moving from side to side. There's shallow areas, deep areas. You've got some nice rocks in there. But you've got a pretty stable system. It's not, it hasn't widened. The stream banks have not undercut or anything like that. So this is at about 5%. On the next slide, which is slide 49, you see another stream at about 8 to 10%. And you can still see that there's relatively good cover here, but you can see some cutting of the banks now. You can see an overall widening of the stream. So we're starting to get into the area of impacts. You can also see a lot more material in the stream bank itself, a lot more rocky and sandy debris in places. Let's move to slide 50. Okay, here's one at 10%, right at 10%. And again, the same thing is very clear. You can see those stream banks are being downcut and undercut. You can see the tree roots that are being exposed there. You can see, again, that a lot more material is laying in that stream bank and that the overall stream bank is basically widened from what it should have been. And let's move to slide 51. This one and the next one show streams at 20% impervious. And here, again, especially if you're a geomorphologist, you'll know instantly, when looking at this. But this is to kind of give you, if you're not a professional, kind of an idea of what you're looking at. You've got a very undercut stream bank. You've got a lot of material over here on the left that's been moved through the system but is now sitting. There's no real evidence, if you compare this one to the 5% one at the beginning, of that sort of pool and riffle structure that we talked about, which is essential both for breeding and fish, sort of day-to-day habitat. So you've got some major changes here. And then let's go to slide 52. Again, 20%, and again, you can just see the impacts here. There's no riparian cover on that left part of the bank, and the bank is just downcut completely. So that's only 20% impervious cover. And obviously in a lot of our urban areas, the impervious cover is a lot more than that. And so we will be very challenged above this level, I think, to, maintain what really is kind of a natural stream system in some of these urbanized areas. And so I believe now we can open it up for questions yet again.
Nikos, I have an online question here from Elizabeth in Michigan who wants to know, does EPA play a role in formally approving or declining a state's decision on an individual NPDES permit?
EPA generally does not review the permits. However, we do in certain cases, and I briefly mentioned this before, but in the case of major permits, our regional offices do review them. Also, if the state is issuing a general permit, say for construction, that covers the entire state, the regional office will review that. But for the vast majority of the smaller permits, we don't review them unless somebody asks us to.
I've also got an online question here from Matthew in New York, Pennsylvania, and he wants to know, if heat is a pollutant, why isn't this addressed in stormwater runoff?
Heat is a pollutant, and it would be addressed. In fact, that's one of the things that we're looking for states to, many states have water quality standards that include heat, particularly for a stream that's been designated as a trout fishery, a cold water trout fishery. You will find heat as a water quality standard So they have temperature standards. And the key, though, is that we need to start translating that goal or that standard into an actual permit limit. So we need to start thinking about things to do to mitigate heat in the actual plans that are going on for a particular site.
And a question from Crystal in Virginia. She'd just like clarification on what our PHS is, which you referenced in slide number 31.
PAH, they're polyaromatic hydrocarbons, and they're from petroleum products, particularly one of the major sources that you can get PAHs from are the coatings that they put on asphalt parking lots and streets. In many places, it's sort of like a maintenance kind of thing to make the parking lot look prettier, and they'll put this black coating on there and sort of paint it on every year. And those things have been found to leach these hydrocarbons, and the hydrocarbons actually dissolve in water, and they're toxic to fish, so that's why we list them as a source. And there are other sources, but it seems that parking lots and roads are the major source.
Great. Are there folks on the phone line that would like to ask Nikos a question?
Yes, this is Steve in Alaska, and I noticed with all of the slides you showed of the streams, there didn't appear to be any development right down to the stream bank, and so I'm wondering what sort of an effect a buffer would have and how much of a buffer we would need to have a significant effect.
That's a good question, and buffers are sort of a key piece to all this. But as you can see from some of those pictures, buffers are not going to protect the stream completely, particularly in areas where a buffer cannot stop that large volume of stormwater that's coming off of a particular site, or in the cases where the stormwater is actually piped right into the particular stream. Obviously, a buffer is not going to do any good. There is a lot of science and research being done on buffer strips, both the construction of them, how they should be put together, and the width of them. And there's not a great deal of consensus as to exactly what the answer to that is. But if you wanted to send me an email, I can send you some information on particular studies that have been done.
Great. Are there other questions for Nikos on the phone line?
I have one.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, back to agriculture a second. You mentioned irrigation return flows being exempt from the Clean Water Act by Congress. Could you expand on what it means by irrigation return flows? Is that returning, like, say, for instance, back to the, the lagoon or hydrology, or what is that defined?
Can you
put those on hold? In many parts of the country, you'll find canals and ditches that are used for irrigation purposes. And also in many places, actually, the fields are actually tiled. So they'll irrigate, and those tiles underneath the soil will transport the excess water back into an irrigation ditch. And that's what an irrigation return flow is that water coming off of a field through either these tile systems or through some other sort of conveyance, and often into these ditches that that you'll see running along the sides of fields and roads and whatnot in rural areas. And those are specifically exempt from regulation by the Clean Water Act and by Congress.
Are there any additional questions from folks on the phone line?
Yes, we have a question from Kansas City. We were wondering if golf course sprinklers are exempt as well.
Golf course sprinklers themselves would not require a permit. However, if the golf course had some kind of, a little retention pond or something like that that discharged into a river, that would not be exempt. But I think most places they're not actually discharging directly to the water, so they would not require an NPDES permit. However, that doesn't mean that they don't need to be concerned about stormwater runoff. And in fact, golf courses really do need to pay attention to the amount of fertilizers and pesticides that they use. And oftentimes there might be local requirements that would kick in as well.
I have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
From New York, we have a lot of issues with road salt and sand, and I didn't know if there were any recommendations or substitutes for the road salt that anyone was using.
That's a good question. And I think, you know, there's sort of different issues when you switch between salt and sand. And both of them have impacts. That's certainly true. There is a fact sheet up on the Nonpoint Source website that covers some of these issues and some of the management practices that can be used as alternatives. So that would be at www.epa.gov/NPS.
Great, thanks for your questions. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Nikos. And
okay, so we're on slide 54 now, and this part of the discussion is to go through the stormwater program, the municipal stormwater program, and to talk particularly about how watershed groups can get more involved in the stormwater management planning that's going on in their communities and in their watersheds. So just a little bit of history, and we'll try to move through this relatively quickly here. As I said before, before 1987, stormwater actually was not regulated. We're on slide 55. And with the Water Quality Act of 1987, it was regulated, and Congress specifically asked us to look at two things. Large cities, over 100,000 in population, and also industrial activities. And then they gave us a third mandate there that's a little bit broader, which asked us to consider who else we needed to permit in order to protect water quality. And so we'll show you the results of that as well. So we have phase one, which started in 1990. We're on page 56, slide 56. And that covered the very large cities, over 100,000 population. It also covered construction sites over 5 acres. And again, not the whole construction site is over 5 acres, but the actual disturbed area where they have turned up the soil, that 5 acres then is regulated and requires an NPDES permit. And also from any industrial activity in about 10 categories. And here we're talking about industries where the materials or parts of the process are outside and exposed to rain. So, for instance, perhaps a pulp mill where they have raw materials outside, or a steel mill where raw materials, again, are outside, or whether part of the process is outside and exposed to the stormwater. And then in 1999, and it became effective in 2003, that's an important part of this, phase two regulations came onto line, and they covered smaller municipalities in quote-unquote urbanized areas, and I'll explain what that means in a minute. Also, construction sites where the land area is disturbed is an acre or more. And then the last little bit actually refers to industrial, and I won't go into that because it's not key to this discussion. So let's move ahead to slide 57. Again, there's three parts to this stormwater program, and most of what we're going to be talking about today is the municipal piece, but the other two parts are out there, and just to make you aware of them. And all three of them rely on pollution prevention. And so we use, in that third bullet there, another sort of techno term, if you will, or bureaucratic term, is best management practices. And that just basically means the things that we're trying to do, either structural devices that we put in place or the things that we do, like good housekeeping practices, to keep stormwater from becoming polluted. So these are all pollution prevention kinds of strategies. Because as you know, with a storm sewer system, there's no treatment plant at the end of that system to treat the water that's coming into it. That pipe just goes straight to the nearest river or lake, and whatever's in there gets discharged. So we are looking at a pollution prevention kind of system here. Let's move on to slide 58. So now we're going to focus on the municipal area. And this is, the place where watershed groups really have the most opportunity to get involved and to make a difference. And as I mentioned, for the phase two communities that are covered by the NPDES program, They're in urbanized areas, and those urbanized areas are determined by the Census Bureau. So every 10 years when a new census comes out, the communities that are regulated could change based on changes in population. So let's go to slide 59, and that gives you a definition of what a municipal separate storm sewer system is, or MS4, which is another bad term of art that we use a lot here, but which means nothing to anybody else. But basically it means a community storm sewer system. And it's, again, a system of conveyances that's owned by a state, city, town, or other public entity that discharges into waters of the U.S. And this is a storm sewer system, so just want to make sure that you understand it's this is different than a sanitary sewer system. In most parts of the country, there are two systems under the ground. One conveys storm water, rooftop runoff, street runoff, that sort of thing. And the other deals with sanitary waste coming from toilet sinks, et cetera, et cetera. And those are separate things. If you flip over to slide 60, you will see the urbanized areas as they were outlined in the 2000 census. And there are about 464 big urbanized areas in the United States. And they include, and you might want to take note of this, there are 5,000 communities within those 400 urbanized areas. So an urbanized area is a big area, like a metropolitan area with a lot of pieces in it. So under phase two, we're regulating 5,000 communities. They do cover about, interestingly enough, about 2% of the landscape, and if you go back to the slide much earlier in this presentation about the impacts of urban runoff, you can see relatively high impacts if you compare those numbers compared to the land areas. 2% is providing an awful lot of impact to our waters. And also, in that 2% of the land area of the United States lives about 70% of the population. So about 197 million people live in those little red dots on this map. So again, just to give you an idea, an urbanized area is a central place, a central urbanized place, and it includes the fringe areas around it, so all the suburbs. And just 2 seconds worth on the definition, the Census Bureau calls it an area with a population of 50,000 or more and a density of 1,000 people per square mile. And again, if you need more information on this, we have a fact sheet on the NPDES website that explains all the details of this. Let's move on to slide 61, which just gives you an idea up close as to what one of these urbanized areas looks like. And as you can see, this is Allentown, Pennsylvania. And it's a rather sort of hodgepodge network of places that don't necessarily make any sense. If you look at it, they're stretching all over the place. You can see the evidence going up to the upper left there of a highway system and a suburban corridor going out that way. And so these are the areas that are regulated by the Phase 2 regulations. Now, in many cases, this sort of hodgepodge, eclectic mix of bits and pieces here has actually been, they've just said, well, we're going to make the entire county the area that we're going to deal with, and so we're going to get rid of this strange-looking shape here, and we'll just deal with the entire county. So that has happened in many, many places sort of on a voluntary basis. Also, the states have the ability to designate the entire area if they want to, so there can be some changes, but this is just looking at purely what the Census Bureau calls an urbanized area. Let's move to slide 62. Just a little more detail. Phase 1, as I mentioned before, covers cities with populations over 100,000. And as I mentioned, permitting authorities have actually designated other areas in addition to that. So they have used their authority. So states have used their authority to designate other areas to be permitted as well. So there are about 235 permits covering about 1,000 cities in Phase 1. And then slide 63 just goes into some more details about about phase two. And here we have about 5,000 smaller communities, as I mentioned, in these urbanized areas. And the permitting authorities, again, have the ability to designate areas outside of those ones designated by the census. But in this case, that has not happened very much at this point. So pretty much the list is the list. On slide 64, you know, just for shorthand, we often talk about these as municipal systems. We think of them as cities, but actually the entities that can be the permitting authority can be very from cities, towns, and counties to public school systems, to prisons, to federal facilities, military installations, parks, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, our shorthand is often to talk about these as cities, but they often include other things as well, including, by the way, state departments of transportation are all MS4s. On slide 65, I mentioned earlier that the Phase 2 regulations include six basic things that every city must do, and we'll talk about those six in detail in the next couple pages, so I won't read this list, but there it is for your reference. So let's move to slide 66, and that's public education. And this is one of the major challenges for the Phase 2 cities, is to provide public education. And here, you know, we're after all kinds of different things, but ultimately what we're after is behavior change. As I mentioned before, or as I should have mentioned if I didn't, there are 5,000 cities, but there's 197 million people living in those cities that we're dealing with, and they all play a part in stormwater pollution, whether it's the lawn that they're managing or the car they're driving or dumping oil behind their house or what have you. They all play a big piece in this, so we're trying to convince them to change their behaviors. And so cities have been undertaking this for quite some time, and there are different levels to those efforts. There are some good examples here from San Diego, Long Island Sound, Washington State and King County, et cetera, et cetera. There's many more also on our NPDES website. If you'll change to slide 67, I just had a couple ideas, and I'll be interested in the next question and answer period if you all have any ideas about how you could play a role as well. But I had a couple of thoughts for how watershed groups can sort of play in this whole area. And I think this is one of sort of the broadest areas where communities need a lot of help. And let me also just mention, too, the 5,000 communities that are regulated under Phase 2 are often relatively small communities with small budgets and limited staff. In fact, we did a survey recently and found that basically they had devoted about one person to the stormwater program and that they had about $10,000 to spend. So these aren't big numbers. So in order to make this successful, we really need a lot of sort of outside help and a lot of outside partnerships to make the whole thing fly. But we have sort of this basic idea of watershed awareness. A lot of people don't know what a watershed is. They don't know what watershed they live in. They're just not sure. In fact, one of the things we did was the After the Storm video with the Weather Channel, which my colleague Ann Weinberg successfully pulled off. And this is a video that educates people on watershed issues and has been very effective. It's been shown dozens of times on the Weather Channel now and been seen by about 6 million people, I think. And we also have copies of that for you if you want to order a copy. You can get it from us, and it's at www.epa.gov/weatherchannel, all one word, and there's information there on how to order a copy of that video, and you can use it in your own education efforts and play it on local access stations and things like that. So plenty of information about that. But as kind of we move down, we need to get people also to understand more than just like what watershed they live in. Once we've accomplished that, we need to get them to understand, so what's going on in that watershed? What are the problems? What are the particular challenges? And they're different for every place. Every place has really a different sort of set of impacts on that system. So we need to do that. And then finally, we need to start figuring out how to make people change or how to get people to change their behaviors. And I mentioned this is one little word here, social marketing, as a technique, but it's a technique that a lot of people are starting to use to really look at the effectiveness of their education and outreach efforts. You know, it's one thing to have a brochure, but is anything really changing because of that brochure? And social marketing talks about a lot of different techniques that go beyond just having a brochure to actually getting behavior changes. And some of them are really very interesting. And we've started training the cities now on how to use some of these techniques, because you can't do it simply through regulation or ordinances or that sort of stuff. A lot of this is going to be voluntary. So that's a key piece. And on our website, there's a guidebook called Getting in Step, which is a guide to how to do this the right way. And so you guys can take a look at that as well if you want a lot more information on how to run a good education campaign. Okay, let's move to slide 68, public involvement and participation. And for our program and the NPDS program, often public participation meant having that public notice, so you have a little legal notice in the newspaper that no one ever reads. You might have a hearing from time to time that no one ever shows up to, and you call that public participation, and you're done. Well, in the stormwater program, we're hoping for something a bit better than that. And this, again, gets into sort of a key thing for watershed groups, too, because this is where real differences can be made on the ground. So if you'll flip to slide 69, just a couple ideas, and I'm sure that you guys can think of many, many, many more out there. But one of the sort of key things that we've seen make these programs successful is to have an active citizens advisory group. And whether that citizens advisory group focuses solely on stormwater or focuses on broader watershed issues, it doesn't really matter. But having citizen participation and a balance of homeowners and business owners, government types, environmental groups, developers, et cetera, on those citizen groups, we really find, of course, it's time-consuming and whatnot to get those groups together, and it takes resources and creativity to make them work. But once they do, they really tend to sort of push these issues through and get real results on the ground. So that's sort of a key thing. And, of course, if you're already involved in something like that, taking up the stormwater challenge is a particularly important piece of that. And good watershed planning is sort of an outgrowth of that, as sort of a key piece. If we don't sort of have an understanding of what problems are affecting the system that we're living in, what kinds of development patterns are coming, what do we predict for the future, how are we going to address these, both through zoning and other things that we'll be talking about, we're sort of missing that big picture. So that's another important part. Volunteer monitoring is another thing that watershed groups often do already, and this can be particularly helpful in the stormwater arena, and I'll mention an area in a moment particularly where that can be of great use to the community itself. And then, of course, you can help in implementation of any of these other measures, and I'll give you some more ideas as we go along. So let's move to slide 70, and this is the third minimum measure here, illicit discharge detection and elimination. And this illicit thing often, makes people sort of wonder, well, what does that mean? It's illicit. Oh, my. But what we're talking about here is two things, illegal connections to the storm sewer system, and they're not necessarily done on purpose, although sometimes they're done on purpose, but sometimes they're just done by accident. Somebody will remodel their basement, and they'll decide, oh, we're going to put a bathroom in, and, oh, look, there's a floor drain over there. Well, we'll just put the bathroom over there and connect it up. And we don't know where that pipe really goes, but, we think that it goes to the sanitary sewer system. Well, lo and behold, it doesn't. It goes to the storm sewer system. So whatever's in that bathroom is going straight out to the river. So that's one kind. The other kind is midnight dumping, for lack of any better term. For better or worse, people have stuff and they want to get rid of it, and under the cover of darkness, they're going to get rid of it. So cities need to track those things down and try to get better control over those. And particularly in older neighborhoods, illicit discharges are a big problem because there's been so many years of changes to building uses and designs and construction that you'll find that illicit discharges are pretty high. Also in areas with a lot of commercial activity have high potential. Generally speaking, in residential neighborhoods that are new, a little bit less so. So if you'll flip to slide 71, just some things that watershed groups can do to help out the city as they implement this program. First is just increased citizen awareness. As I mentioned before, citizens really don't know that the storm sewer system just goes straight to the river. They don't understand that there's no treatment on the end of it. So just kind of those, you know, no dumping things or storm drain stenciling or marking, you know, where you're making them aware that if they dump their motor oil down the storm drain on the street, you know, they're going to pollute the nearby river. Those kinds of things are very important. Also, many cities are putting in some kind of a hotline so that if somebody sees somebody doing something illegal or potentially illegal, they can report it, and then the city can go check it out. So just kind of advertising those things and letting people know. It may be possible in some places that they need help manning that telephone line and answering questions and referring to them to the right department within the city. So that might be something as well. Another thing that they need to do under this program is, believe it or not, many cities have no idea where their storm sewer system is. They don't know where the outfalls are. They don't know where the pipes are going. It's hard to believe, I know, but it's true. And so one of the first tasks that they have to do under this minimum measure is to map that system. And so they can use help just going out and walking the streams and finding these outfalls. And we're looking really for any kind of, you know, pipe that's coming out into a stream. We want to know where it is. Is anything coming out of it during dry weather? What's its condition? Does it need repair, et cetera, et cetera? So that whole sort of mapping thing is an important part of this. And in many places, actually, citizen groups have been very helpful in this area of going out walking the streams, filling out forms that just say, you know, where a particular outfall is and that sort of stuff. It's relatively simple stuff. Lastly, I just suggest that it's possible to educate businesses. A lot of businesses don't understand. You'll find, a lot of places with dumpsters with no lids on them, or the lids are left open all the time, and it rains, and the dumpster starts leaking all kinds of nasty stuff, and they don't understand that that's a problem. Or restaurants that take the, you know, grease or whatever and dump it out behind the place, or hose off the mats, from their kitchen areas. There's all kinds of educational opportunities there that are pretty low-key that could be done. And then oftentimes, these smaller cities just don't have the time and the resources to do. Let's move to slide 72. This is the construction minimum measure here, and every city has to manage construction sites that are over 1 acre within their boundaries. And they need to do quite a number of things to do that, including reviewing plans and inspecting them and making sure that that best management practices are being implemented and that the sites are clean and that basically the dirt is staying on the site during the construction period. So this is a big responsibility for the municipalities. And again, by the way, we have a series of fact sheets on our website that describe all these in a great deal of detail, so you can look at those on the NPDES website. On slide 73, just some ideas about things that watershed groups could do potentially to help out again with this. And in a couple cities, we've seen some very interesting things where the city has put together like a little kit, which shows some pictures of good and bad things that go on a typical construction site, and then let citizens take that little kit with the pictures and just go out and kind of do these drive-by assessments. You don't go onto the site, you just stand on the street and look at it, and you look for common problems. Like if you see dirt on the street, that's probably a problem. If you see that place where the trucks are driving in and out of the site is all muddy, that's probably a problem. There's just a number of very simple things that could be done, and then again, the citizens sort of become the eyes of the city, and when they see a problem, they can tell the appropriate official, and the official can then do a more thorough inspection. But again, oftentimes, the cities just don't have enough people to go around and just can't keep track of all these things on a daily basis. So there's a good role there. It might also be possible to help educate some of these contractors and subcontractors. A big problem is subcontractors. They don't understand sediment and erosion control at all. They don't know why those silt fences are there, and they drive their trucks right over them. So it might be possible to put together some small, educational effort just to let people know what this is all about and why it's important. And then, of course, possibly also working with other citizens groups that might be interested as well. There are a lot of people, a lot of neighborhood associations that are kind of interested in these issues, particularly when they are impacting their particular neighborhood. And so you could liaison with them. Let's move to slide 74. And this is the operations of the city itself. All cities do things like street sweeping, and they have vehicles that they maintain. There's a public works department that often has a yard or a garage where all kinds of things are going on. There's road salting facilities during the winter, road repair, public park maintenance, lawn mowing, all those sorts of things. And all these things have the potential to impact stormwater. And so cities have to basically try to clean up their acts for any of these areas that are potentially impacting stormwater. And, again, this is a place where citizens, I think, and watershed groups can play a role. Oftentimes, training programs for employees are pretty low on the funding priority list. And so you'll find a lot of the rank-and-file employees really don't know how to do this. And so if you can press, you know, for some built-in kind of education program, I think that would be very important. Another thing we've seen in a couple of areas that I thought was very interesting, for instance, in Massachusetts, the police, they did some education of the police officers to help them recognize stormwater problems. And so they gave them a very short, like 20-minute briefing on what are typical stormwater problems, and they gave those policemen a little card that they could clip onto their visor in the squad car that just reminded them to look for these things. So as they're driving around the city, you know, they're seeing people, you know, dump leaves and grass clippings down the storm drain. They know to stop and just give them a friendly reminder that that's not something they should be doing. So there's all kinds of opportunities there to get other people that you wouldn't necessarily think are going to be part of the stormwater team into that sort of team because they're out in the community every day. And, of course, if you see any catch basins or other places that need help, of course, reporting those to the right folks so they get the attention that they deserve, again, being that eyes and ears for these small communities. Let's move to slide 76, and we have another opportunity for questions.
I've got a question here, Nikos, from Lori in Baltimore, Maryland, who asks, when you say that the stream is at 10% impervious cover, do you mean that this particular section of the stream is located in an area that has 10% impervious surface?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean. So we're talking about the drainage area that comes into a particular stream. And, of course, that drainage area can be small or large, just depending on the topography. But when that drainage area is at 10%, not necessarily right up against the stream, just that any area that's draining into that stream gets to that 10% level. That's when we're starting to see uniformly impacts on these, again, smaller streams, not on the Mississippi River, but on these smaller headwater streams.
I've also got a question here from Mary in Texas who's asking, has anyone done paired watershed studies between using just impervious cover control versus using engineered structures to control sediment runoff and buffers to control peak flows?
I would say probably not. I have not encountered one like that. That's certainly a good idea, but where we're at right now in the stormwater arena is that a lot of this, A, is pretty new, and there's not a lot of money out there, really, to do these kind of studies. So they haven't been undertaken perhaps as much as we would like. So I'm not aware of any. If there's anybody online that is, it'd be great to know about that.
Another online question comes from Jack in Indiana. He wants to know, does installing vegetative barriers at existing parking before storm drain lots dramatically assist filtering stormwater pollutants, or is this only a minor help?
Actually, that's a great best management practice. If I had more time, one of the things that I like to talk about is parking lot design. And pretty much every parking lot in the United States is designed the wrong way. particularly if you think about it, if you look at almost any, like, large parking lot, they have those little islands with the trees in them. Well, the dirt invariably is higher than the pavement. Well, that's not going to help us in the stormwater world. So if we can get that dirt in those islands down below the level of the pavement and get rid of the curbs so that the water can run in there, that can make a huge difference in terms of both the pollutants, because pollutants coming off of a parking lot are relatively simple. Some dirt and dust, maybe some hydrocarbons, a little bit. But dirt is a great filtering material for any of that. And also, if we can get infiltration, then we don't have those big, flashy volumes coming off those things as well. So those are very simple, inexpensive retrofits that could be done almost anywhere and would be very, very effective both for pollutant control and for volume control.
I'm going to go ahead and unmute the phone line for you, Nikos, so folks have questions on the phones.
Frank? Hello, this is Melissa with Kansas City.
Great. Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, we were wondering if the outreach materials you've been mentioning are translated into Spanish.
Okay, another question?
Hang on.
Very good question. Yeah, some of them are in Spanish. If you look at our website, www.epa.gov/NPDES, and right on the front there, you'll see something that says Stormwater Outreach Materials. You can find some of these in Spanish. Not every single one, but a number of them are in Spanish. And you're free to download the files and use them however you like.
Are there other questions for Nikos on the phone line? The questions on the phone line? Okay, we're going to go ahead and move on. I'll let you take over at slide number 77, Nikos.
Okay, everybody. We're on slide, actually, let's move to slide 78. And we're kind of winding down here a little bit. But I wanted to talk specifically about the permanent stormwater controls. At the beginning of this thing, I mentioned permanent stormwater controls on site are what we call post-construction, for lack of any better term. But these are the stormwater controls that will be on that site for the rest of its useful life. We talked about construction a little bit, and often a construction period is relatively short. You can build a couple houses or a little commercial development in several months. But that commercial development or those houses may last for 100 years or more. And so we need to deal with the runoff that's going to come from those things, over the long term. And so I sort of single out this post-construction area or these permanent stormwater controls as kind of a key piece for having long-term success with the stormwater program. And so what I wanted to do is just give you a little bit of an overview about what cities, again, have to do under this minimum measure, and then talk to you about two new, relatively new ideas that I think have great potential for improving kind of the effectiveness of our activities in this area. So let's begin with what the cities have to do. Again, each city, those 5,000 cities, we're on slide 79, those 5,000 cities that I've been talking about all have to develop a post-construction program. And that post-construction program includes some legal mechanism, usually in an ordinance, to address runoff from new development areas and redevelopment areas that disturb more than 1 acre. And so one thing I'll point out to you right away is that this does not cover existing areas. So, however, to be successful, like we were just talking about parking lot designs and retrofits, we really do need to think about the existing areas and things that we can do as well. But the regulatory requirements address new development and redevelopment areas. And so what we're looking at here, again, is a combination of structural things, like we were just talking about, retrofitting those parking lots so that they would have better infiltration and pollutant removals. But we're also talking about non-structural things, too, the kinds of things that we do, like street sweeping and whatnot, that are maintenance activities that prevent that pollution as well. And then a key piece which many cities are having a hard time with is this long-term operation and maintenance of these things. One of the more common stormwater best management practices that you'll find out there are these stormwater ponds. They're pretty common in many parts of the country. And they do a reasonable job of treating stormwater, getting the pollutants out, slowing down some of those volumes that we've been talking about, and that sort of thing. However, if they are not maintained, they can fail very quickly, and they do require maintenance. And so one of the biggest challenges that cities have is, as they're setting these programs up, is how to handle this operation and maintenance of these things. And they essentially have two choices. They can either choose, for instance, in a new development, they can choose they can get the contractor to put these things in place, and then they can choose to maintain them over the long term. So the municipality would take ownership of these stormwater ponds, for instance. However, that has its own set of issues and requires budget and staff and all that sort of stuff. And so in many places, they're requiring that the homeowners association is responsible for the maintenance of these things. And that, again, can be a lower-cost solution, but it's not a completely free one because often homeowners associations don't have the expertise to maintain these things properly, don't know what to do. People buy and sell units. The boards of these homeowner associations change. Management companies change. And in many, many places, you'll find sort of a quick failure of a lot of these stormwater devices. In one city in Kentucky, they did a survey of 300 ponds and other stormwater devices that had been put in over the last 10 years, and they found that every single one of them was failing because of improper maintenance. So this is a big challenge, and it's something that watershed groups kind of need to be aware of to sort of help the city in budgeting for this and staffing for this, making sure that if they are going to go the route of having homeowners associations do some of this maintenance, that there's proper education programs, et cetera, et cetera. So I can't emphasize enough how important that piece is. Let's move on to slide 80. And again, this just talks a little bit about more of the elements that need to be included. And because conditions are different in every part of the country, different rainfall amounts, different soil types, different climates. We need to find best management practices or permanent stormwater controls that are appropriate for the community and for the watershed. And again, we're looking at minimizing those water quality impacts, that pollution aspect of it, and then also trying to get infiltration maximized so that we're more towards that pre-development runoff curve that we talked about earlier in the presentation. So we're trying to find ways to not create a lot of impervious surfaces or to minimize their ultimate impact so that we don't have a lot of water running off because of these development activities. So again, watershed planning efforts are, I think, key to looking at kind of a macro scale for this. As we said, they have to have an ordinance, but they also, in many cases, need to look at other parts of their municipal ordinances to find things that are getting in the way of good stormwater management. And the Center for Watershed Protection has some good information on how to review codes specifically to look at stormwater impacts. But some things that you might not think of that actually do have a big impact are fire codes, because often in the fire codes, you have requirements for the minimum width of roads, and those roads, you know, can be incredibly wide and not necessary depending on, particularly in residential areas that are not heavily trafficked. You'll often find these 30 or so foot wide roads that just don't need to be there and just are adding extra impervious surfaces. Another thing is requirements for parking lot design. Many communities have requirements for parking lot design, and as I said, most of the parking lots that are in the United States are designed the wrong way. So we need to sort of really take a fresh look at those and revise them as necessary, and also find ways of clustering developments to share parking areas. In many parts of the country, you'll see these sort of strip developments, and every store has to have its own parking lot. Well, why is that really necessary? Most of those parking lot spaces are never used, except possibly on the day after Thanksgiving. So is that really necessary? Can we find ways, you know, that several stores can share a parking area and that parking area is used, is sized and used a lot more appropriately than just for that one day? So let's move to slide 81. These are, again, are some basic elements of what a city needs to do. And, again, mostly just so you have kind of an idea. But we do encourage cities in their general and comprehensive plans, whatever the terminology is that you might use in your area, to not only have stormwater mentioned explicitly, but also to have watershed planning efforts mentioned there as well. And then the city will need design standards, as well as the ordinance that we mentioned earlier. And those design standards are often borrowed from the state level, but they have specific guidance on how new development projects are developed, the size of the roads, the use of curbs or not the use of curbs, all those kinds of things. And then as well as the design for particular structures like wet ponds and things like that. So a city will need those as well. And what's in those is important, too, because that's what the developers are going to follow. And we'll talk about why that's important as we kind of move through this. Finally, cities have to review and approve the stormwater plans for new development and redevelopment, it should say on that bullet. And then, again, the whole maintenance area is a key piece to making this effective. They also need to have penalties for when there's noncompliance. We won't get into that too much, but and they also need to have training and education programs, which is another area where watershed groups might be able to help. And then I made the last one, of course, just yellow, just to emphasize it yet again that the maintenance of these things is perhaps the most crucial aspect of it. If we move up to slide 83, jump ahead two, I wanted to talk about now, got kind of the basics here, but one of the new tech or new ideas that's come out is something called smart growth. And smart growth kind of tells us to look at our overall development patterns at the macro level. So we're looking at kind of the watershed level scale. It sort of, you know, is pointing out a lot of things that are going on right now that really aren't very good, not only for water quality and watershed health, but also sort of our quality of living as well. And there's a lot more information, again, on our EPA has a Smart Growth webpage that goes into this in great detail, and there's a number of documents that you can also find there to provide more information. But basically, we're kind of looking at this trend of low-density housing that's going on right now, the fact that we're converting a lot of farmland from farmland use to sort of these big suburban lots, and then the dependence on cars, the way we lay out these subdivisions and whatnot, are in, you know, sort of increasing dependence on cars to do anything. So let's move to slide 84. And I saw this and thought that this was a particularly startling graphic here. In purple, you can see the growth in population for the United States as a whole. And in red, behind that, is the growth in land that we're consuming through development activities. And you can see this is projecting it out to 2025, but it's our sort of consumption of land is vastly outpacing our increases in population. And so that just kind of gives me pause to, you know, and I think should give us all pause to kind of sit back and think about, well, what are we doing? And, you know, does this kind of far-flung suburban development make sense, you know, for us in the long run? Not only for, you know, as I mentioned before, stormwater, but, you know, for lots of other things as well. Let's move to slide 85. There's two pictures here. And one of the easy misconceptions that people can have is that low-density development, like the one on the left, is good for watershed health, and high-density is bad. And, well, in the simplest sense, that could be true, but in if you look at it a little bit more deeply, it actually turns out not to be true. So let's look at that in a little bit more detail here. On slide 86, you'll see three different scenarios here, just to give you some basis for comparison. The first one talks about one unit on an acre. Scenario B is four housing units per acre, and unit C is the high density one at 8 units per acre. And at the bottom of each of those, it gives you the impervious cover, the runoff per acre, and the runoff per unit. So in scenario A, we've got impervious cover at 20%, because 1 acre roughly is about 20% impervious. And we've got about 18,000 cubic feet per year, per acre and per unit running off that site. And then compare scenario B and scenario C. And you can see impervious cover is going up. It goes up to 38% in scenario B and 65% in scenario C. So instantly, if you're just thinking about that, you think, oh, that's bad, that's bad. And of course, runoff is increasing as well, right? Runoff per acre goes up to 39,000. But look at the interesting thing is runoff per unit actually drops. And that's the key piece of this. So let's flip to slide 87. The same sort of scenarios here, but just looking at it in a slightly different way. Again, what's the in this case, what's the total runoff and the runoff per house, which we had before, and the impervious surface. But again, look at the total runoff, which is the middle line there. And where you've got 8 houses on 8 acres, your total runoff is 149,000 cubic feet per year. And as you increase the density, that total runoff, again, decreases. So again, this is kind of counterintuitive. I mean, a lot of people think, well, spread out and stormwater won't be a problem. And of course, now there is, don't take this the wrong way, but, you know, if you develop every acre at 8 units per acre, well, you're going to have a big problem. So it does require that some land be set aside and not developed. That's kind of the key. So if you flip to slide 88, you'll see what we're talking about there. And again, these three scenarios, again, looking at the same basic idea, but you have 10,000 houses on 10,000 acres is the first one. What do you get with that? That's 20% impervious, right? And that basically that whole watershed is now developed. In scenario two, you've got 10,000 houses, on 2,500 acres. So that gives you a certain runoff volume. It does give you a higher impervious on the per site at 38%. But you got over the whole watershed, you notice you have dropping impervious surface cover as a whole. So now here we're under that magic 10% number that we've been talking about. And take the same thing up to 8 units per acre. So you've got that one small area in the bottom of that watershed developed, pretty heavily developed. But look at the impact on the whole watershed. So it drops down considerably. Now again, you know, this can't be taken out of context, and we've had some cases where it was taken out of context, but we do need to preserve that land area that's not being developed in order for this to work. If you just fill up the whole watershed with 8 units per acre, you're obviously going to have problems. But you're probably going to have more problems, realistically, if you just develop the whole thing and you're not conserving any land area. So on slide 89, just some different scenarios, you know, sort of an artistic kind of thing, or not very artistic really, thing to look at here. But, you know, kind of the question, okay, 20 years out, your population doubles, what's your watershed going to look like? Or what's your couple watersheds going to look like? Are you going to have them all fully developed, every square inch? Are you going to have concentrated development in certain parts, et cetera, et cetera. And on slide 90, it's basically asking the same thing yet a slightly different way. Are you going to have, you know, four, your choices, are you going to develop 4 watersheds? Are you going to have 2 that are partially built out? Or are you going to have 1 that's partially built out and the rest are untouched? So there's a lot of these sort of macro level decisions that I think we need to be more aware of to properly manage stormwater over the long term. Slide 91 just gets into some of the smart growth principles. And again, we're talking about kind of thinking about things at the macro level, the big watershed scale level here. And we're talking about mixes of land use. And as I mentioned before, we're talking about compact or clustered kind of building developments. But they're also thinking about other things in smart growth, like walkable neighborhoods. You know, can we walk from our homes to businesses? Can we, you know, reduce the number of car trips that we're making, et cetera, et cetera. Also, open space preservation is very important here. And as I said, you know, we really have to have kind of an active conservation program to make that all work over the long term, because it certainly won't if we don't really think about it. And then transportation choices, too, you know, getting out of the cars and having more buses or more light rail kinds of options, things like that in your higher urbanized areas. But again, kind of minimizing those car trips, you know, or to go to the post office or go to the grocery store, you don't need to get in a car. Okay, been given the signal, so we have to speed up things a little bit here. I'm going to skip 92 because we've covered that pretty much. Slide 93 shows a couple pictures again and just kind of asks you this theoretical question in a different way. You've got that picture on the left that shows the typical development patterns and what kind of development is that going to be served by, these big parking lots that we talked about. Okay, slide 94, and let's go up to 95. Actually, we'll talk about low-impact development a little bit. So now we're switching gears, and we need to talk about micro-level stuff. So low-impact development is kind of at the site. So what we're going to look at here is individual sites and the things that we can do that are pretty creative to minimize those stormwater impacts on a site-by-site basis. So we want to keep that smart growth in mind for the big picture. But we also, and they're not mutually exclusive either, to look at this micro level as well. So let's move to slide 96. Unfortunately, a lot of the ways we've been managing stormwater in the past have ultimately caused a lot of the problems that we're dealing with now. No offense to any engineers in the audience, but the idea of kind of moving stormwater around with big pipes and getting it out of our way has caused all those kinds of problems in rivers and streams that we've been looking at, both because of the volumes in large measure. So what we're trying to look at here with this low-impact development is managing that stormwater on the site, and the big key word here in that second bullet is infiltration. If we can maximize infiltration, we'll get magically much lower pollutant levels, or none, perhaps, and also reduced volume, or perhaps no volume increases at all. So there's a number of things that we really should try to do, particularly in new development areas where we really have that opportunity to do it right. On slide 97, some more bullets here about what low-impact development is all about, and I won't go into all that, but the fourth one here is pretty important, too, and I'll point out an example. It actually will reduce costs for the builders as well. So it can be a very attractive option for builders, ultimately, and they reduce their infrastructure costs, and I'll talk about that in a second. So on slide 98, some pictures of the kinds of techniques that we're talking about, and we'll go into some of those details as well. Let's move to slide 99. And again, this idea of smaller scale BMPs or techniques on-site, making sure that the stormwater doesn't get very far from where it fell so that it doesn't pick up pollutants along the way, those sorts of things. Let's move to slide 100. And again, here's where we can reduce stormwater pipes, curbs, and gutters, all that kind of infrastructure that we spend money on, not only to put in as a capital expense, but that will require maintenance over the long term. So using a lot of these techniques can minimize or even eliminate a lot of that kind of infrastructure. We need to reduce building footprints. We need to pay attention to sensitive soils, slopes, things like that, so that we're not disturbing those sensitive areas as well. And, of course, you know, the key piece of all this is reducing impervious surfaces overall. Slide 101 goes into some more of it, and again, I'll leave this just for your reference at the moment. And we'll turn to slide 102, and I've already kind of mentioned this, but, you know, this is that whole parking lot thing, and any chance that we get, we really need to start changing this. We don't need curbs, we don't need gutters, we don't need those tree islands that are a lot higher than the pavement. We got it, and it's amazing to me, too, that, frankly, you know, this is not anything new. We've known how to do this for the last 10 or 15 years, and yet you could probably count on one hand the number of parking lots that are really designed the right way, because people just keep doing the same old thing. And some of this is impacted by local requirements as well. There are local requirements out there that are causing builders to do the wrong thing. So again, looking at the requirements in your cities to see if there are impediments there, or you know, and talk to your builders because they know. But let's see if we can use different techniques like these biofilters at the top left where the runoff goes into them and the soil and the plants treat that runoff and we get infiltration. Different kinds of pervious pavements. A number of years ago, they came up with this idea of pervious concrete. And in its early stages, it was not a great practice. It didn't work as well as it could have. But the industry has made a number of changes to that and have tested it extensively. And it's very different than it used to be and is usable both in warm and cold climates now and can be used just about anywhere except for a heavy-use street where there are trucks present. So it can be used on residential streets, it can be used in driveways, it can be used in parking lots. It's used extensively in Georgia and Florida right now, and it's, believe it or not, basically the same price as regular concrete. And the maintenance issues are little, few, so it's a great alternative that's been often overlooked. So I encourage you to look at that. And it can be used in cold climates as well. There was a concern for a long time that the freeze-thaw would crack the stuff. And they've improved the way they mix this and the materials that they're using so that that doesn't happen. Let's move to slide 103. It gives you a list of some of these common low-impact development techniques. And on slide 104, one of the most basic ones that we can do almost anywhere is disconnect downspouts. Downspouts and new developments should never be connected. They should always be run out like this example here. But in many existing areas, we can disconnect downspouts easily without any flooding impact. Now, I say that, you know, in many places, there's always caveats. In places, you know, where there's not enough land area to infiltrate, whether water tables may be very high in a particular area, and you wouldn't want to do that, you know, in certain, you know, house-by-house kind of considerations. But large majority of places, there's plenty of land area to infiltrate. So we really need to sort of take a look at that. And it's very low cost. Hacksaw doesn't cost very much. on slide 105, swales are another important thing, particularly swales that don't are not designed only to transport the water away, but to infiltrate it. So the design of the swale is particularly important. And it can be designed in such a way that people are often concerned about standing water. And in heavier rainstorms, it can be designed in such a way that it will transport some of that water away in a very heavy rainstorm. But for the average quarter-inch rainstorm that probably encompasses 80% of your rain activity in any part of the country, infiltration is the way to go. And many places that infiltration can happen in a couple hours. So swale design is very important. On the next page, page 106, bioretention is a little bit more sophisticated and can be used, again, around parking lots, as you see there in some of those examples, or around housing developments. And these are actually engineered medium where they'll dig up the ground and they'll put in a particular matrix of rocks and soil and sand and whatnot so to increase the holding capacity. They'll use particular plants that will survive in the conditions that that they're experienced, whether it's a dry area or a very wet area. And sometimes they'll also include, for heavy rain events, some kind of an overflow device within this thing. So if you get that, you know, once every 2 year, once every 5 year big rain event, you know, you won't have flooding. It'll transport it that excess away. So these are a little bit more engineered, but very, very effective for your sort of routine stormwater control because you won't have any pollutant discharge and you won't have any volume for almost any storm event. Page 107, I've talked parking lots to death. But retrofits are possible. You can see the curb cuts there. Very simple. You know, get those those islands down below the level of the pavement, and voila, you have a well-designed parking lot. So I won't beat that one anymore. 108 is rain gardens, and these are pretty similar to the bioretention cells that we talked about, but they're lower tech. These are things that you can, that homeowners can do themselves in their front yards and their backyards. It's a great thing to get a gardening club, master gardeners, to start doing these things. They'll be sort of very interested in putting them in, and this is one of those sort of, we mentioned earlier in terms of education and how to get people to change their behavior. Well, this could be a great example of this kind of thing, because other people will see people doing this and they'll say, well, what is that you're doing and why are you doing it? Oh, that looks nice and I want one too. And so you don't have to do a lot as long as you get those kind of key people, in this case, you know, say your garden clubs or your master gardeners, to start doing things. It'll sort of spread. There's a community, Maplewood in Minnesota outside of Minneapolis, where this very thing has taken off, and everybody's got a rain garden. It's just amazing. And you're like, well, how did that happen? And it happened because a few people started doing it and other people were curious. So it's a great thing, a great sort of citizens involvement kind of thing, as we mentioned before. Slide 109. Again, I talked about this some already. There's all kinds of options out there for porous pavements, the pavers on the top left and right, concrete, and there's also pervious asphalt as well, which is a relatively new thing, but another option. On slide 110, green roofs. This is something that's not very common in the United States at the moment, but is very common in Europe. And they do a couple things really well. One is that they can often retain small rain events entirely, so there's nothing coming out of the downspouts from a particular building. In Chicago, on the City Hall, there's a green roof, and it's a rare rain event there where that where there's actually a discharge coming off that roof. The other thing they do is insulate the building. They provide great insulation. So your energy costs go down. They are a little bit more expensive to install up front, but the interesting thing is that they last much longer than a normal roof because the roofing material itself is not exposed to sunlight and UV damage. And the other thing they also help to reduce is the heat island effect, which is another thing that EPA has been focusing on in ultra-urban areas. So Chicago is one place. They have a great website on green roofs, and they have requirements now for new development within the city of Chicago has to have green roofs. Municipal buildings have to be retrofit with green roofs. So there are some things going on out there. It's something to look into. Slide 111. Is rain barrels. These are popular with citizens, and again, a good way of getting citizens involved. And we've seen that be a very good sort of community-based activity. And the last one I'll mention here is soil amending. I mentioned earlier that on slide 112 that often soil gets so compacted that it turns into an impervious surface, and just a little bit of amending that soil down about 12 inches will make dramatic differences in the amount of runoff from particular sites. And I think with that, there's some other slides in here that you can look at, but I think because of the time, I'm going to just open it up for questions again.
Well, I do recognize that we do have a few moments for questions, but I'd first like to draw everyone's attention to where they can go to obtain Nikos's contact information. If you're online, you simply click on the home icon at the top, and it brings you back to the home page, which has Nikos's email address and phone number. And at the bottom, I want to draw your attention to two things. One is a link to additional resources, and the second is a seminar feedback form. I'd like to remind everyone to please consider filling it out as we do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve our webcast. Also, on the link to additional resource today, we have links to a few resources. For example, we have a link to EPA's NPDES stormwater website, a link to EPA's polluted runoff urban webpage, a link to EPA's LID website, and a link to the Smart Growth Network, among a few others. So I do want to let folks know that those are available. And I believe we do have a few moments for a few questions. Okay, well, I'd actually like to go ahead and conclude today's webcast. I'd like to especially thank Nikos for presenting today. And, of course, thanks to everyone who joined us. We do encourage folks to return to www.epa.gov/watershedforum for upcoming webcasts. And that ends our webcast for today. Thank you.
Thank you.